This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I have the pleasure again today to read an essay by Dave Creer, Viroqua's own master naturalist, who works right here in town for Valley Stewardship Network. This one titled Invasion. Dave grew up on a small farm in Spring Green, just about an hour east of Viroqua. After earning a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from the University of Minnesota, he spent 35 years in the aerospace field, all while enjoying outdoor activities like camping, bicycling, birdwatching, fishing, and gardening. He earned his Minnesota Master Naturalist certification and participated in many citizen science projects. He also volunteers with the Friends of Vernon County Parks and Forests and has been coordinating bat surveys and chimney swift surveys to better understand these species locally. So here's Dave's essay called Invasion. We sometimes seem to be on a balance wire between our hopes and dreams and our hubris of thinking we can control the world. The stories behind invasive species around the world highlight this over and over again, and paraphrasing the famous line in Top Gun says it all. People, your ego is writing checks you can't cash. Despite our aspirations, we almost never control invasive species like we think we can. The reality is that most invasive species are purposefully brought to a new area and then get out of control. The list of species humans have moved around the globe is long and often with the best of intentions. We want to grow better crops, have pets, provide habitat, or prevent erosion, so we bring a plant or animal from their original home to a new place, and it gets away from us. In the new area, without all of its regular competition or predators, they can sometimes destroy native species and actually change the environment. I love how Jim Reinhartz from UW-Madison notes that some new species seem to somehow just play by a different set of rules than native species. In their native territories, they aren't invasive, as they have co-developed in their biome with predators, competitors, and diseases to coexist in some balance. When they get here, the competition is different, and they can sometimes find environmental niches to exploit. One way some plants do this is using unique weapons like allelopathic compounds. One version here is black walnuts. The trees produce a chemical in the soil, in the case of walnut, it's juglans, that dampens down other plants, allowing young walnuts to sprout and grow with less competition. We all know not to plant tomatoes or petunias or blackberry near a walnut tree. Invasive species do this also, but almost on steroids, honeysuckle and buckthorn create nearly complete dead zones around themselves to keep competitors out. This is one of the reasons we care. When you have a grove of honeysuckle or buckthorn, they are surrounded by bare dirt all around because the plants are suppressing competition. When a flood or rainstorm comes, the water can wash away much of that soil. In a more balanced environment, there would be many species of plants living there that could hold on to the soil, reducing erosion. Another reason we care is biodiversity. In general, humans can't predict what the environment is going to look like tomorrow, next year, or in 20 years. Will it be wet, dry, hot, cool, tough winters, or mild winters? To support resilience, the more biodiversity, the better. So no matter what happens, there are many species that can adapt and flourish. It's like the old saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Researchers and scientists often use 10,000 years ago as a time prior to Europeans colonizing the world to refer to native plants. Of course, species moved around the planet prior to that, but very, very slowly. As humans began moving around the planet, and we can now move something from China to the U.S. in less than a day, species moving has accelerated an unbelievable amount. Some examples of non-natives in the driftless area include ginkgo trees, Norway maple trees, soybeans, alfalfa, cows, and cats. Non-natives aren't usually considered to be much of a problem. They survive here and can even thrive, but they don't expand out of control. Ginkgo trees are a good example. We plant them because they are hardy and can grow in a polluted urban environment. What we don't see is thousands of ginkgo trees expanding without restriction wherever we plant one. As Douglas Tallamy says, while a ginkgo tree doesn't offer as many positives as a native tree, it isn't a huge problem either, as it just is on the landscape. Invasive species are a type of non-native that expand out of control. In Wisconsin, the state tracks 131 invasive plant species. It goes up to 202 if you include animals, invertebrates, fish, and fungus. Interestingly, there is only one bird on the list, a Quaker parakeet. Almost 80% of our invasive plants have come from Europe, either directly or from Asia, after they were naturalized in Europe. This makes some sense. The majority of our colonization came from Europeans who came to North America over and over again for centuries. Of those, almost 80% were intentional for landscaping or food or forage or for erosion control. Our egos were confident the species would do what we wanted. Some seemed very desirable, and it's easy to understand why they were brought here initially. The multiflora rose was introduced to the U.S. from Japan in 1866 as rootstock for grafted ornamental rose cultivars. In the 1930s, the U.S. Soil Conservation Service recognized that they were very hardy and easy to propagate, so they recommended it for erosion control as wildlife habitat, especially for pheasants, bobwhite quail, and cottontail rabbits, and on highway medians as crash barriers and to reduce headlight glare. Vernon County was not immune to this push. Annual reports of the County Soil Conservation Department from the 1950s and 60s shares how many thousands of feet of fence line have been planted with multiflora rose seedlings, partially funded by state and federal programs. Today, farmers are not fans of the plant as it can spread uncontrollably in our typically sunny pastures, and cattle are reluctant to go near it. I know several farmers who spend thousands of hard-earned dollars year after year ripping out the bushes to keep their pastures clear. How does it thrive? Leaves emerge very early in the spring, earlier than native plants and even most other invasive species, and it holds onto its leaves a little longer in the fall, allowing it to produce more energy and grow faster. Some invasives can be eaten, like garlic mustard, Asian carp, and wild parsnip. Culturally, we don't consume much Asian carp here, but there is an effort to rebrand the four invasive carp species here in the U.S. as kopi and commercially harvest and sell them. The nearest application of this is Illinois. One of the best fish dinners I ever had was in China, and I learned afterwards that it was Asian carp, so maybe we just need to know how to prepare it. Asian carp really refers to four species of carp known collectively in China as the four great domestic fish, and they are farmed and eaten prodigiously there. As we've now come to expect, Asian carp were introduced here on purpose to aquaculture ponds and wastewater treatment facilities in the southeast U.S. in the 1970s to help keep them clear of weeds and parasites. Floodwaters caused these exotic fish to spread into rivers, streams, and lakes, and they create significant disruption to native fish by filtering water and out-consuming them. One of the four species is the star of the spectacular videos you've probably seen of fish leaping out of the water as boats go by. Wild parsnip is another edible invasive species. It was originally brought here as food in 1609 from Europe. In Europe, it isn't invasive because it co-evolved with the local flora, so you don't see the intense clumps spreading wildly that we find here along roadways and riverbanks. Growing up on our farm in Spring Green in the late 1970s, wild parsnip was unknown. Now, 40 years later, it's a common, pernicious plant that every child must be warned about to prevent skin burns when the sap gets on your skin and reacts with sunlight. Imagine how fast it can spread to go from unknown to a persistent danger in just 40 years. Controlling invasive species often brings up uncomfortable decisions. By the time we notice an invasive species, it has already invaded, often quickly and in large areas, and can sometimes be so established it's considered part of nature, natural or not. When discussing removal or killing of invasive species, one of the oppositions is, once we remove whatever it is, there won't be anything left. My response to that is usually two parts. Once the invasive species is removed, we can add back in the native plants that have been displaced, and leaving them just makes their spread larger and more established. So it's better to do something than end up with a landscape dominated by just a few invasive plants. We had a large honeysuckle in our city yard. I felt so bad about getting rid of it, as the birds really seemed to like it. They try to shelter in it and eat the fruits. One summer, I bit the bullet and chopped it back by about a third in the spring while planting a native elderberry bush next to it. As expected, there was some regrowth on the honeysuckle, but in the fall, I cut back that new growth plus another third, so it was dramatically smaller than originally. The second year, the elderberry really took off. So by midway through the second year, I pulled out the honeysuckle completely. Within 3 years of starting the process, the honeysuckle was gone, and the elderberry was nearly as big as the honeysuckle had been. I'm so glad I did that and stuck with the process. The native bush statistically provides better shelter and more nutritious food. For woody species like shrubs or small trees, the general method to control is either pull them out entirely, if you can use skid steers, or cut them down and apply a herbicide with a dauber to every cut stump. For large areas, it can be quite labor-intensive. Cutting without treating can stimulate some of the shrubs and makes them even more aggressive, with many regrowth shoots off a single stump. It does force the use of an herbicide, which many people don't want to do. So the question becomes, is a spot use of an herbicide worth it to contain an invasive species growing out of control? I understand the concerns about herbicides, but one positive about this approach is that the herbicide is applied to a plant that we want to eliminate permanently, and it's not in our food chain. According to the USDA, in Wisconsin, we use about 13 million pounds of herbicides per year for corn and soybeans. There aren't good records for herbicide use for invasive species control, but using a dauber to apply herbicide to a stump uses fractions of an ounce of herbicide. So conservation folks and volunteers across the state are probably using herbicides by the hundreds or thousands of pounds, not millions of pounds annually. To further biodiversity, it's a trade at least I am willing to make. For non-woody plants, pulling can sometimes be done, and it's so rewarding to grab a young sweet clover plant or garlic mustard in a damp spring soil and pull it out with a long taproot all pulling out. As great a feeling as it is, though, it's very labor-intensive and physically demanding. When the plants get too big, which doesn't take long in the season, it isn't a viable approach anymore. Sometimes mowing can prevent seed production, as there's a narrow window when the plant is in bloom, but the seeds haven't set yet. The bad news is this is right when prairie birds are nesting, so the perfect time to mow things like wild parsnip or sweet clover is when the birds are just nesting and fledging. Prairie birds are in dangerous declines, so mowing down their nests is a tough decision. For now, I'm generally siding with the birds who need all the help they can get, while the invasives can be slowed down in other areas or in other ways. It's not just plants either. The zebra mussel is a freshwater aquatic invasive species from Russia and Ukraine. They cause over $1 billion of damage annually in the U.S. by clogging up valves in water and power systems. They arrived in the U.S. in 1988, so have only been here for 35 years or so. The zebra mussel feeds by filtering particles from the water. I've seen lakes with zebra mussels that are crystal clear, which seems like it would be good. It isn't natural, though, and sunlight can penetrate deeper than usual, allowing plants lower down to grow and then decay as they die in the fall and fouling beaches. They also outcompete local mussels here and in parts of Europe where they're also invasive. In infested lakes, people need to wear water shoes to prevent their feet from being cut by the sharp shells on the lake bottoms, which can be 100% covered by them. The fungus that causes white nose syndrome in bats was transported from Europe to the U.S., where it was first identified in New York State in 2006. It arrived in Wisconsin in about 2015, and in the last 3 years has spread past the Continental Divide to all but two states. Where it has been found, it has wiped out 90% of some of our bat populations that hibernate in caves together. Anything that destroys 90% of a population in just a few years is a real problem. The good news is that the individuals who have survived have some kind of immunity and have been passing that on to their young. So populations have bottomed out and are recovering. It is very slow, as bats only have one pup each year. But in the eastern U.S., there is hope the worst is over. Lest you think this is all a global plot against the United States, we've certainly done our fair share in exporting invasives to the rest of the world. Our raccoon is invasive in Europe and Japan. Our large and smallmouth bass were introduced to pretty much everywhere but Antarctica, and they have caused the decline or extinction of birds and smaller native fish and amphibian species. Our native red-eared slider turtle is among the 100 worst invasive species in the world. Our American mink was brought to Chile, Argentina, and Europe starting in the 1920s for commercial fur production and are invasive there. The American bullfrog is an invasive species in over 40 countries around the world. Our eastern gray squirrel is invasive in England and Europe, outcompeting the native red squirrels for food and habitat and spreading the deadly squirrel pox virus. This causes nearly 100% fatality in infected red squirrels, but which the gray squirrels are immune to. This is almost the exact same story in the other direction, as the fungus which causes our bats to die from white nose syndrome, but European bats are immune. Much like here, the British grapple with the idea of killing one species, the gray squirrels, to help another, the red squirrels. We're having the same debates here about removing barred owls to save spotted owls, or killing lake trout to save cutthroat trout in Yellowstone National Park. It's the same debates and efforts the world over. In a success story, Australia managed to extirpate the gray squirrel in the 1970s through early identification and removal. Insects get a lot of press, whether it's the Japanese beetle, the gypsy moth, now called the spongy moth, or the emerald ash borer. Less well known, the Filoxera is a louse native to North America that was introduced to Europe in the mid-1800s. It ate grapevines that were used in winemaking, and by the 1870s, France had lost over two-thirds of its vineyards, over 5 million acres. Our native vines had resistance to the louse, so they grafted French vines onto North American rootstock. It's estimated that over the 20 years it took to implement, it cost over $50 billion in today's dollars. Even so, 30% of French vineyards were unable to ever be replanted. The potato beetle, native to the United States, had spread to Europe by the late 1800s, where it became well established, especially during and after World War I and II. In the United Kingdom, where they have stringent quarantines, it has been identified 163 times and eradicated each time due to early identification and reaction. In East Germany and Poland in the 1950s, communist propaganda was saying that American planes dropped the beetles to sabotage the potato crops there, and they were called Yankee beetles. In reality, the beetles were already there and impacting the crops. Our American black cherry tree is considered very desirable here, as their bloom is beautiful and fragrant, and they produce berries, and they host a huge number of moths, which are excellent bird food. In Europe, not so much. Here, they grow in balance with the rest of the forest community. But European soil does not have the fungus Pythium, which slows the expansion of the black cherry tree. So there, the trees expand invasively. School groups have field trips to pull saplings out, much like we do with buckthorn or honeysuckle or garlic mustard. There are some successes, though. In Lake Superior and other Great Lakes, the sea lamprey is finally being controlled. The sea lamprey made its way into the Great Lakes through canals from the Atlantic Ocean in the early 1900s. Lake trout harvests from Lake Superior dropped by 95% as the sea lamprey decimated their numbers. Through a combination of lampricide, targeted chemicals that kill just the invasive lamprey, barriers, and dams, the sea lamprey population has been reduced in Lake Superior by 90%. There's still work to do, especially since COVID reduced lamprey control efforts for several years, but it is a great recovery success story for lake trout, salmon, and cisco. In the last few months, the murder hornet was deemed extirpated from the U.S., an invasive hornet species which can wipe out a honeybee colony in just a few hours. Early identification, a strong education program, and swift action helped us push back this invader. So what's a person to do? There are so many parables that I can think of to help us from being paralyzed by the enormity of the issue. A journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step. So get out there and do one thing, or one thing a day, and soon you'll start to see a change for the better. The starfish tale. A girl walking along the beach sees starfish washed ashore. She picks them up and throws them back into the ocean so they don't die. An old man asks why she is doing this, since there are thousands of starfish and she can't save them all. The girl replies, "I made a difference for that one." We have our own local version of this. When mussels were stranded and dying in the Wisconsin River during the drought in 2023, some members of the Friends of the Lower Wisconsin Riverway got together and saved thousands of them from dying. Get out there and make a difference for that one thing you notice today, and save that one. Don't plan to do it alone. There are 376 million Americans today. Imagine if each one of us did just one thing a day, every day for a year. That's over 1 billion acts a year. That can make a lot of difference, even if it's just small things each day. Invasive species aided by people have been going on for many hundreds of years. The stories behind many of these invasions are fascinating, and these are just a few. Look up an invasive species you're particularly interested in, and there may be a great story showing someone's great dream and how it went wrong. Enjoy the tales. And that's David Creer's essay called Invasion. If you're interested in a handy herbicide dauber for treating stumps, look up Buckthorn Blaster. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.